Welcome to the Maine Historical Society podcast. These podcasts explore the experiences of Maine people in a changing world and the connections between local, state, and national history. To learn more about our programs, please visit us online at www.mainehistory.org/programs.
Hello, and welcome to another virtual program with Maine Historical Society. I'm Kathleen Newman. It is June 17th, 2021, and this is From Chinese Laundress to Mother of the Year, bringing the story of Toi Langun beyond the model minority myth. And this is a program for our Begin Again series. And joining us tonight is Dr. Andrea Louie. Andrea Louie received her BA from Bowdoin College and her PhD in cultural anthropology from the University of California, Berkeley. She is a professor of anthropology at Michigan State University and founded the Asian Pacific American Studies program there. She is the author of Chinese-ness Across Borders, Renegotiating Chinese Identities in China and the United States, and How Chinese Are You? Adopted Chinese Youth and Their Families Negotiate Identity and Culture. She has done research on Chinese international students at MSU and is currently finishing up a National Endowment for the Humanities Fellowship, for which she is writing a book on her maternal grandmother, who was selected as US Mother of the Year in 1952. Dr. Louie, thank you so much for being here. I know the audience joins me in thanking you and welcoming you.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm pretty sure the audience, a large portion of the audience, may be my very large extended family,
who is we're very happy to have them with us.
interested in hearing more about our wonderful family matriarch. So I'm gonna share my screen. So I'm framing this presentation as a series of questions that I'll proceed to answer in the process of telling the story of my grandparents' immigration to the US and also the selection of my grandmother as US Mother of the Year in 1952. So how did I become interested in researching my grandmother's story? This is actually a story, you know, that I, like all of my relatives, grew up hearing, especially people of my generation, her grandchildren. She was an inspiration to all of us and would always encourage us to study hard, make a lot of money. She would actually say some version of this, you know, you smart girl, study hard, make a lot of money to each of us. But she also understood each of our individual strengths and interests, which, you know, was amazing because she had so many children and grandchildren. If you look at my family story from the outside and as it's been presented in the media, it is definitely one, or even, you know, as we as a family understand it, it is one of success attained through hard work and education. And our family can in some ways be seen as a model minority Chinese American family that achieved the American dream. But I'm gonna try to complicate some of these issues as well in some of these terms, not to at all diminish her accomplishments, but to put them in a larger context. And that's what I, as an anthropologist who's also interested in studying history, I'm not switching over to history, I'm looking at family history from an anthropological perspective. That's something that I'm trying to do through this project, which will eventually become a book. And here's a photo. I actually was at the Guangzhou Overseas Chinese Museum with some relatives from my father's side, and we stumbled upon this exhibit that included my grandmother. And this is one of the press photos from her selection as Mother of the Year in 1952. So the series of questions that I'm using to frame her story are pretty straightforward. And there are things that I always wondered as I was growing up, although some of them, like Chinese exclusion, I didn't really learn about until I was in high school or college. You know, but the first question is, of course, how did they end up in Portland, Maine? And during the Chinese exclusion era, which I'll explain a little bit more, why is it they ran a laundry? And in fact, my father's family also ran a laundry. Why? You know, I always thought it was a coincidence, but in fact, it's not. What is the U.S. Mother of the Year Award? And how was she selected out of all mothers in the United States in 1952 for that great honor? Clearly deserving, but again, you know, how did people come to learn her story? And then what was the larger significance of her award to her, to her family, and also to the American public? Because it did get national and international attention. How does her story relate to the model minority myth, which is something that I'll explain, and it's a really important concept in Asian American studies, if we think historically and also in the present. And then finally, what are some ways that her story can be told outside of the official media versions? You know, how can we do more justice to the depth of her story and the different ways it can be told? And what is left out of these public narratives? So the first question, how did Dogen and Toyla Ngun end up in Portland, Maine during the era of exclusion? So Chinese exclusion was in effect between 1882 and 1943, although it effectively restricted immigration until the 1960s. This emerged out of labor competition. Chinese laborers were seen as taking the jobs of white working class men. And the series of, you know, there's a lot more depth I don't have time to go into here, but the series of laws was enacted to particularly bar Chinese laborers from entry. So Dogen Ngun was in that category, but he still managed to enter the United States without documentation via Canada in 1912. So he took a boat to Vancouver, took the Trans-Canadian Railroad across to Montreal, took a train down, or somehow got over the border. I'm not sure of those exact circumstances. Because he was in the United States without documentation, he was, you know, gainfully employed. He worked at a variety of places, but ended up running a laundry at 640 Forest Ave in Portland, Maine. So on August 16, 1917, a Chinese inspector whose job it was to, you know, basically find the Chinese immigrants and determine whether or not they were in the United States legally, came to interview him at the laundry. We have a copy of that initial interview, and Dogen's response is actually using an interpreter that I found through the National Archives. And then he was brought before Commissioner Arthur Chapman on August 26, 1917. And it's a very long and interesting transcript. It's actually in the archives of the Maine Historical Society, thanks to my Aunt Amy and Uncle Ed, who I think found a copy, and then Gary Libby also, who's been working to build that collection. But the most interesting part of the interrogation, it goes on and on and asks him very specific questions. He claimed he was born in San Francisco. They ask him very specific questions about the streets in San Francisco, whether he was able to go to school and things like that. But toward the end, the counsel, Mr. Kehoe, asks Dogen, "Are you ready to go to war for America?" It's right here at the bottom. And Dogen replied, "Sure." And he said, will you fight? And Dogen replied, "Yes." So a lot of people in my family think that this is something that swayed the commissioner to believe that Dogen was telling the truth about having been born in San Francisco and therefore being a citizen by birth, because of the Chinese exclusion laws, he could not naturalize, right, as a Chinese individual at that time. I've also, from historian colleagues, heard that some commissioners were more lenient than others and more likely to give people the benefit of the doubt. So there's really no way to know why he was found not guilty of being in the US illegally. But essentially, if the commissioner had not made that decision, then he wouldn't have been able to go back to China to marry my grandmother, and the rest of our family wouldn't be here in the United States. So what I find really fascinating is that Dogen's existence in the US as a legal individual was created out of the system surrounding Chinese exclusion, right? The interview at the laundry with the inspector, the hearing in which he was found not guilty. And from there, he was very savvy. He hired a lawyer in Portland, I'm blanking on the name right now, I think it was Connolly, Mr. Connolly, to help him with a lot of this paperwork. He basically said, I wanna go back to China to get married. He actually didn't specify who in the paperwork, even though he and my grandmother had been married by proxy already at that time. And there's a story associated with a relative or a friend coming back and from China after having met my grandmother and convincing him, you really need to go back and marry this wonderful woman. But the amount of paperwork for him to get permission to go back to China as a returning US citizen was incredible. And you know, there's a very thick file of his that I found in the National Archives. So he went through a lot of effort to be able to go back to China and bring my grandmother back. They had a formal marriage ceremony, an in-person marriage ceremony when he was there, and then he brought her back. I was able to also locate my grandmother's immigration files. They were actually with US Customs and Immigration Services still, even though they should be with the National Archives. So I found some documents that I think the family hasn't seen yet. This is her certificate of identity, and here's a picture of her. Basically, they took the Empress of China over and again landed in Vancouver, took the train to Montreal, went through some interrogation there. And then in Boston, she was detained for 10 days. Dogen was released right away, right, because he had the paperwork. She basically had to prove that she was the wife of Dogen, the wife of a US citizen. So they subjected her to a lot of questioning, and also Dogen to some questioning. They matched their stories. There was a little bit of inconsistency, but in the end they released her. And during this time, Dogen was very attentive. He brought her food from Chinatown. There's some also correspondence in the file about him checking with his lawyer to see what was taking so long. Why wasn't she being released? So he had contacted the lawyer, and the lawyer had contacted the immigration people in Boston. There's a lot I'm cutting out here for the sake of time, but they made their way up to Portland, Maine. My grandmother remembers, I did an interview of her with the help of my mother and Aunt Doris when she was 100 years old. And she remembers the sounds of the horses clopping on the cobblestone streets. She said no cars back then, things like that. But she very quickly adapted to laundry life, learned how to run the laundry. Dogen bought her a sewing machine, which we actually as a family just donated to the Maine Historical Society. I believe that's the original one, and encouraged her to make American style clothing for herself. So the Chinese clothing that she brought with her remained unworn, but a lot of that has all been donated to the Maine Historical Society and as part of this beginning again exhibit. Some of it will be part of that. Another thing that I always wondered growing up is why did they run a laundry? Why did my father's side of the family run a laundry? But laundry work was not something traditionally done by Chinese people in China, right? Laundry work was something that marginalized population did, right? So the Chinese tended to go into laundry work, sometimes farming, restaurant work, things that could be done within an ethnic community or that somehow filling a niche. Chinese hand laundries were institutions across the United States, both on the East Coast and West Coast. Chicago, there's a famous ethnography written by a sociologist named Paul Hsu about the Chinese laundrymen in Chicago. So it wasn't a coincidence at all, right? Laundry work was grueling. Laundry work was something that, you know, if you had a large family, everybody could pitch in, which is what the Goon family did, even before Dogen passed away. And this was not a mechanized laundry, right? Everything was done by hand, very, very time consuming, very hot. But really, it's important to think about the larger context for this laundry work. It's not something that would have been the first choice, right, for immigrants, but it was something that allowed them to make a living. Another, I think, major accomplishment by Toy Len Goon, and there's a whole story that goes with this, I don't have time to go into it, but she actually purchased 615 Forest Ave, which is where the where she basically lived until, while she was Mother of the Year and until she retired. And to actually own property, right, was a big move toward financial stability for the family. They lived on the second floor. The laundry was on the first floor, but they also did a lot of their daily tasks on the first floor, cooking, studying. The children would, you know, study in between doing their laundry chores, all helping out. And then and Josephine would help with the cooking and some of the cleaning. So everybody in the family had a role based on gender and on age. They all, in interviews, talk about knowing what they needed to do to get things done, to help out in the family, even prior to Dogen's passing. So Dogen unfortunately passed away in 1941 in the VA hospital in Togus, Maine. And his death certificate indicates that he died due to hypertension and myocardial damage. My uncle Edward was able to find all those records, get all those records from Togus, so that was, it's been very valuable in my research. And prior to that, he had been ill. He had had his leg amputated, so he was not able to help out in the laundry even prior to becoming ill and passing away. Most of the aunts and uncles that I interviewed have really strong memories of my grandmother taking the bus all by herself to visit him in the hospital, you know, not knowing how to read or write English, but figuring out the bus system, standing out in the cold, you know, showing her dedication to my grandfather. And also being, of course, distraught when he passed away and you know, crying at his funeral. But she didn't have a lot of time to grieve. You know, she had 8 children to feed. She worked 16-hour days, and the children pitched in. In the interviews of the children, they talk about how she was offered mother's aid, a form of welfare assistance at the time, but thought that she would lose her property, not be able to continue to pay on the mortgage of the property, and also thought that the family would be taken to different places, right? They wouldn't be able to stay together. So she basically told Uncle Carol, the oldest, that you need to take off time from school. He was a high school student at the time. And you're the oldest head of the household now, the oldest son, and you need to help keep this family together. And all the other siblings as well, you know, continued to pitch in. Uncle Dick also took some time off. In the interview that I did with her when she was 100 years old, she talked about, you know, her memories of the laundry. She talked about, and just of her life in general, right? She didn't have an easy life in China, and I didn't really have time to go into that, but she had been in an arrangement made by her mother, raised by a foster family, a more wealthy foster family in China. So she had to work hard then. She had to work hard after coming to the United States. So she talked about, you know, walking everywhere in China, and then working hard in China, and also in the US. And she, this quote really stood out to me, saying one lifetime is like other people's working 4. And I don't doubt that at all. It may be even more than 4 lifetimes, because she worked hard her whole life until she retired, and set a really strong role model for her children. And all of her children ended up becoming very successful by American standards. They all went on for further education. A lot of them got scholarships. And I have a list here of the different occupations, and forgive me if I didn't list everybody's credentials, but you know, very successful in working within the US educational system. They got good grades. They were star students at Deering High School. And then they went on for further education. And I think this is something that contributed, right, to her being seen as this model mother, and that contributed to her being selected as Mother of the Year. But I'm gonna talk a little bit about how that process worked. But first I wanna show you this video, this film reel that Gary Libby had shared with me and is also at the Maine Historical Society. It's very brief, but it talks about her selection, and please signal me if the audio is not working.
A Chinese laundry in Portland, Maine, and that magical universal word, mother. Mrs. Toy Langoon, a widow, Chinese-born, carrying on in her husband's place, bringing up 8 children to be fine American citizens. Her eldest is a doctor. One son is in the Navy. Another is an MIT graduate. Still another is studying law. All were encouraged to go to college. Today, she's honored by the National Golden Rule Foundation as American Mother for 1952. With daughters Doris and Janet, she modestly takes her place in the limelight, giving her 8 children all the credit for her success.
Okay, so yeah, what is the Mother of the Year Award? We know it's important, right? We know it's national. We all grew up being very proud of it, but what is this award? So the Mother of the Year Award is given by the American Mothers Committee Golden Rule Foundation. And that was founded in 1931 by Eleanor Roosevelt to honor the role of women and particularly mothers, but also to draw attention to mothers who needed aid as in their language, dependent mothers and needy children. But they also attached to this idea of helping mothers, they also had ideas of what an ideal mother should be. So the ideal mother should raise their children with moral qualities, you know, clearly be live by the golden rule, be a role model for their children and for society. So I want to talk a little bit about Clara Soule, who was an Americanization teacher who was a friend of the family and came to check on the family after Dogen died, but she actually was a friend of the family prior to Dogen's passing. She was a retired school teacher from Portland and was also involved in the Portland Business Women's Association. And she was not in charge of the nominating committee for Maine Mother of the Year, but she was part of this process. So the Americanization movement, it's very interesting. It was designed, it came about at a time when there was debate over whether immigrants were good or bad for the United States, right? And so the Americanization movement was an effort to teach new immigrants, not just Chinese immigrants, but immigrants in general, including European immigrants, to be American, right, through English, teaching them English. And there's also an element of Christianity in there as well. So Clara Soule believes strongly in, you know, a part of her focus was on the Chinese laundrymen and restaurant workers, in addition to others she had taught. So she came into the laundry quite frequently, trying to teach Toy Langoon English, but Toy Langoon didn't really have time. And she actually was able to learn on her own some. My Aunt Amy, who's been a great resource for this project, tells me about how she learned from the supermarket flyers and asking her children, what is this called? You know, and then associating the name with, you know, the word and sounding out the word banana and so on and so forth. So Clarisol would come by the laundry frequently and knew that the children, despite the death of their father, despite having to work, right, were doing very well. And you can see here that, depending on the size of your screen, it might not be too clear, but she really does emphasize her character, her integrity, her amiable disposition, deep understanding, and general pleasing appearance. I don't really totally understand why that's important, but and talks about her strength as a mother, her sacrifice for the good of her children, talks about Dogen's service in World War I, and you know, how Toylan carried on operating the laundry. And you know, I think this is really interesting, describes her as a controlling force, and despite the lack of formal education. So, but really emphasizes how successful the children are, how integrated they are into the community, and in essence, how, I guess, assimilated or Americanized they are. And so the nomination is successful. She's selected as Maine Mother of the Year, and then all of the state Mother of the Years went into a national competition, and she was chosen as U.S. Mother of the Year. So, you know, that focus on motherhood is very interesting. You know, at this time period, in the 1950s during the Cold War, there was an association between the domestic sphere, mothering, and the containment of communism, right? It's kind of a lot to talk about in the context of this talk. I can take questions on it if you want later, and a lot of people have written about it. So I think in a lot of ways, her story, right, fit this model, but at the same time it didn't, right? Because clearly she was not this white middle-class mother that was envisioned in this idea of Cold War containment and domesticity. She departed from that. And in fact, her story was very different from the majority of previous mothers of the year as well, although they had selected a Black Mother of the Year and I believe a Native American Mother of the Year prior to her award. So I want to talk a little bit about what her story that sort of took on a life of its own in the media and by politicians. And again, I want to emphasize this is not taking away anything from her work and her accomplishments, right? But it was also very, I guess, fortuitous for those trying to boost a certain image of the United States, right, as a liberal democracy, that she was from China, that China, right, had just become communist in 1949. So she received not only local, but national and international attention. And this was from different people, right? The merchants, the local merchants gave her a lot of awards. They gave her a new stove. They gave her plaques. They threw a luncheon for her. A lot of attention by the local community, which was amazing. My mother and Aunt Doris recall going out to a restaurant for the first time in their lives ever as part of these festivities, not knowing which forks to use, you know, because they had been, you know, not able to afford those things and fairly sheltered. She also received a lot of attention by the Chinatown community. So there were parades in Boston and New York. I have a photo later of her waving from the parade from the lead car. But she was also presented to Congress by Representative Hale of Maine. She was received by Bess Truman, as you see here at the White House. So this is, you know, amazing. She got to shake the First Lady's hand. She had lunch with the Taiwanese ambassador, and this was all covered by the media, right? This was something that received, like, as I said, not only attention in Portland, but throughout the United States and internationally. There was coverage in the Chinese language papers. There was, she received awards from the Taiwanese government and so on and so forth. Some of the editorials I found to be very fascinating. There was, a reporter named May Craig, who wrote a lot of these editorials. And this article from May 1952, titled Miss Schoon Overwhelmed, Happy as She Prepares for American Mother Ceremonies in New York City, quotes Ms. Soul as saying, it could never happen in China. And really, it's a great boost for democracy too, coming at this time. I guess it will mean something when it gets behind the Iron Curtain. The story points out that Toilang Goon came from China 38 years ago and that her homeland was in the grips of communism. So as I said, this shouldn't take anything away from her own accomplishments, but clearly Ms. Soul, May Craig, the reporter, and the Senator Hale and the other people saw that her story would have significance, you know, beyond the amazing story itself, right, of the family's success. This was a time, you know, during the Cold War when the U.S., as I said before, was being critiqued for, you know, basically you say you are want to be the leader of the free world, but look how you're treating your minorities. You're not treating your minorities well. So this was a perfect, and there was also the conflict in Korea. So Asia was very a strategic location at the time for the United States, right, to spread its influence. So the fact that Toilang Goon was from China and that she was able to succeed in the United States was very significant and received a lot of media attention. Another editorial written by May Craig specifically talks about Congressman Hale, saying that he struck a blow for the Cold War in Asia and bringing her to Washington, D.C. for a visit with Ms. Truman and a meeting with the Chinese ambassador, and that the Japanese and other foreign correspondents would be given the story, and then that it would reach other people in Asia. It was also broadcast through the Voice of America and other U.S. news agencies. And Ms. Craig's quote said, all over the world, the communists are telling the hordes of non-white people that Americans are hypocrites, that they do not mean what they say about democracy. They picture all non-whites as downtrodden, scorned, mistreated in the United States. And obviously the implication is that this will show, right, that Chinese immigrants can become successful through their hard work. But a little bit more about the historical context. The 1950s was also a time, or actually post-World War II, was a time that the attitudes toward Chinese and Japanese families were shifting from being seen as a bachelor society, or in the case of the Japanese, you know, enemy aliens, to more of a focus on women and families, the acceptance of these families. This article was actually from 1940, and it focuses on Dogen and the careers that he planned for his children. This was also from the Portland Press Herald. This quote here, it's sort of academic, so I apologize for non-academics. It's by Ellen Wu, who wrote a book called The Color of Success. And she talks about the model minority myth and traces it back actually to the 1950s. Usually people think of it as something that happened more after 1965 changes in immigration laws. But she again contextualizes it within the United States aspirations for world leadership. You know, she says here, battles against fascism, and communism, and the goal of seeking global legitimacy for the United States, right? So basically what she's talking about is the symbolic end of Chinese exclusion in 1943, but also more focus on positive views of Chinese and Japanese American families, as a way to show the US as an inclusive nation, and also opening up some of the barriers that had previously existed, right? It doesn't mean that all of them were lifted, but I think in addition to the incredible merit that the Goon children had, there are also increased opportunities. And in her book, she documents other families who have had, you know, the children were able to go to college and become professionals and things like that. So that's something that was happening in the larger context of the time, in addition to the Goon family. So essentially what Ellen Wu talks about in her book is this idea of the model minority. And in Asian American studies, we talk about it as a myth, right? So that's why I have a question mark there. So the model minority myth, and this still exists now and it's still very relevant. It says basically that Asian Americans are successful both in education and work, or that the educational success leads to success in work and career, that they're intelligent, that they're hardworking, that they don't rock the boat, you know, don't break the law or cause trouble, but also maybe that they're so somewhat passive. There's more to that, but that's sort of the basic definition. But this myth also has a lot of downsides. For one thing, it is often, the success of Asians is often seen as being rooted in cultural values, but we know that not all Asians have come from the same religious or cultural backgrounds. There's a huge variety, right, and within Asian American population. Also, it sort of rests on them having kind of these secrets that attach to these cultural values that make them perpetually foreign. And we see this now, right, with the xenophobia that's happening, and the, you know, the idea that Asians don't belong here, which is attached to this model minority myth idea. It makes differences between Asian Americans in terms of ethnicity, religion, socioeconomic status, and so on, invisible, kind of lumps them all together. And it really kind of erases Asian Americans who are struggling economically or from learning differences and so on, creates a lot of pressure to achieve. And I think the biggest thing for me is that it's often used to drive a racial wedge between Asians and other minorities. It can be used to say, you know, look at these exemplary Asian minorities. They've worked hard. Other minorities, other immigrants aren't working as hard, and therefore they're not succeeding. What's wrong with them? So there's been a lot that's written about how the model minority myth is used as a racial wedge, and Asians occupying this middle ground between Black and white, which is true, but also therefore being, in some cases, being seen as honorary white. And, you know, obviously that benefits certain people, but also in the larger racial climate, it can also cause some issues. So I want to focus on, you know, in my research, I've found a lot of ways that we can go beyond the media coverage and even the family story to hopefully enrich our understanding of Choi Lin Goon and her accomplishments. So the first is that the media really emphasized her as a mother and as a wife, the wife of a veteran. And that was obviously true and obviously very important. I mean, she was an incredible mother, an incredible grandmother, great grandmother, but she was also a businesswoman. And I think the fact that she worked in a laundry, that the laundry, I have a chapter in my book about the spatial layout of the laundry, and how that allowed the domestic and the business work to be intermingled, allowed for her work as a businesswoman to sort of become, be covered over, right, by the focus on her role as a mother and a wife. And in fact, before Dogen passed away, she was very instrumental in making these business decisions, like buying 615 Forest Ave. There was also a little bit of a downside in the sense that she was in the public eye. She wasn't fluent in English. She had to close the laundry and find someone else to, you know, take the work during that time. And that might've led to some health issues or her being a little bit self-conscious in later years. And again, that's not diminishing at all her accomplishments, but she did talk about, you know, having this, she actually, one of my cousin Terry remembers her talking about having a nervous affliction from, you know, the stress of being in this in the public eye, even though she also loved it. So my Aunt Doris talks about her being some, and other aunts and uncles talk about her being somewhat of a ham and really loving that that attention. So I think both can be true. There was also, of course, in the 1950s debates about whether she was modern or traditional. And some of the news coverage talks about her being modern, and others will take the same, you know, situation, the same evidence, you know, of her running her laundry and say that she's traditional and fulfilling these traditional gender roles, which I find very fascinating. So that reflects the ideas and some of the debates in the 1950s. I already mentioned the fact that she wasn't Black or white. She was a single mother, but she wasn't unwed. She was a widow, so that positioned her to be seen as a model minority and for that to be used in the media in the ways that I mentioned before. A really important part that I'm finding through my research is, even though the news coverage emphasized her Americanization and her assimilation, and she was incredibly adaptable, as we talked about before, making American clothes, learning how to cook American food. My Aunt Jo talks about how she would bring recipes home from school, from home economics, and that my grandmother would somehow make them even more delicious without having to look at the recipe. She got to know her neighbors, shared recipes with them, you know, learned how to cook Western food from them and so on. Very adaptable and integrated into her local community, but she was also a part of this transnational Chinese community that connected her both to other Chinese in Boston. She was part of a Chinese Women's Association. Also very important to her was being part of the Goon Family Association in Boston, and also very devoted to her family back home. So once my three of my uncles married the Chin sisters, who were from Toisan in China, and they could read and write, they helped her get in touch with her relatives back in China and write letters to them and send money back. She was very dedicated to those relatives in China to support them. And she knew that they had fallen on, you know, hard times, and that they, and this was part of a larger tradition of Chinese immigrants, particularly from Toisan, from that region of China, sending remittances back to support people there, because it was very hard to make a living. And there's a whole history attached to that. I could talk about natural disasters, famine, that not much arable land and so on. So she really did continue these connections to China. My cousin Janine told me about staying with her when she was 100 years old and asking her about her mother, and our grandmother getting teary-eyed and saying, you know, I miss my mommy after all these years. I still miss my mommy. And then my cousin Roseanne recalled overhearing an interview that my Aunt Amy and Uncle Ed did with her, in which she talked about, among other things, you know, being crying when she was leaving China because she thought she would, you know, her family would starve to death because they really didn't have enough to eat. So I think that part of her story was sort of erased from the US media coverage. You can kind of understand why, right, during the Cold War and the focus on her Americanization, but I think it's really important to bring this part of her story out as well. So this is the famous photo of her with I think what my Aunt Doris calls the Queen Elizabeth wave, the royal wave in the parade. But some takeaways is that histories aren't static. They're written by people in the present, and we can always find out more things, and people interpret them in different ways. So I've been doing, it's been wonderful doing interviews with my aunts and uncles and cousins and some of their children, just about what her story means to them, the way they understand her story and the family history, and, you know, the different ways that her story and the family history can be contextualized. I think her story also talks about shifting ideas about race, positioning of Chinese Americans, about gender roles and belonging. I think the theme for Chinese Americans historically and even now is belonging, but also to an in tension with not belonging, with exclusion, right? So, you know, that's the part that I didn't really have a chance to talk about here, but that's a large focus of my book project as well. So I just wanted to end by saying thank you, and I apologize if I leave anybody out, but thank you to the Maine Historical Society and to Gary Libby, who has collected most of the materials about the Chinese in Maine and helped get me started, and continues to collect things related to the Goon family and others, and always sending me things. To my Aunt Amy, who is like a walking encyclopedia and has an incredible memory, was actually entrusted with writing my grandmother's biography by my grandmother. So she has a lot of the knowledge and that she's shared with the family. And I interviewed her for hours and hours and keep finding out more. All of the descendants of Toi Lan Goon, her children, her grandchildren, great-grandchildren, who have helped me with this project, everyone else who supported my research, thanks to the National Endowment for the Humanities. And I really want to dedicate the project itself, which will eventually become a book, I'm still finishing it up, to her legacy, to my grandmother's legacy. And here's my contact info if anyone has wants to get in touch. So I will stop share.
Thank you so much, Dr. Louie. That was really interesting. And we're getting questions from the audience. Someone's asking about Toi Lan Goon. Do we know, like, how well was she accepted by her community and neighbors? Was there much of a Chinese community for her and her family to associate with when she was living in Portland?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And Gary Libby's has written quite a bit on the Chinese in Maine. There was a huge Chinese community in Maine, but there were Chinese restaurant owners, Chinese laundrymen. Toi Lan Goon had a few very close Chinese female friends. And then Dogen would go to drive. He had a car, so he would drive to Chinatown every month, go to the family association, read the newspaper, bring back groceries for her. So they were very much integrated into the Chinese community, even though it wasn't large in Portland, Maine, but also into their neighborhood. So she did make lots of friends locally, including Miss Soul, who we mentioned before, a neighbor from Syria. My Aunt Amy talks about how the first thing that my grandmother did when Amy came to visit with my Uncle Ed was bring her to the local store and meet the butcher, who gave her a good cut of meat, and the other merchants who would give her the biggest fish and things like that. They were all very, very kind to her. The family was very well known, I think, because they ran the laundry, because they were a large family, because of this, the children being, very good at and their academics and so on. So all I've heard was, very positive experiences of being welcomed by the community.
Related to that question, can you speak to it all how large or widespread the Chinese and Asian population in Portland and in Maine was at that time? Do we know, were they living in mostly urban centers like Portland, or is it a community that's spread out across the state?
That would be a question for Gary Libby. From what I remember from his articles, there were especially laundry work, if you think about it, laundries need to be spread out, and they're usually in places, right, you need to serve the local community. So there were laundrymen in other cities in Maine as well. There's the famous Daniel Coffs, right? He came, I think, long before my grandmother did, right? I don't believe he was in an urban area. So yeah, it wasn't just isolated to Portland. But again, I'm not an expert on that. Gary Libby, I think, would be a good person to ask about that.
Do you know when the first Chinese immigrants came to Maine? And when did ultimately the sense of a Chinese community emerge in Maine?
Again, that's probably more of a question for Gary Libby. For this project, it's kind of a more focused type of history that I did. So I'm really looking at the period of time when my grandparents came in. But certainly Dogen purchased the laundry from probably another Goon family member, right? So, you know, the Chinese had been in Maine for quite some time. And as I mentioned before, the Koff family had, you know, come even earlier. I don't know the exact dates. And I do get the sense that there was a broader community. One of Gary Libby's articles talks about police raids on Chinese men, laundrymen who would get together to gamble and things like that, right? That was their pastime, right? That was, if you think about in the context of social isolation, and discrimination, they if the rare times that they had time off, they would get together and you know, do fun things like gamble.
I'm by no means an expert on this topic. If someone in the audience knows better, they can correct me. My understanding is in Portland, we started to see Chinese immigrants arriving in like the decade before the Civil War. So like as early as like 1858, I'm sure there were probably some Chinese immigrants coming into Maine even earlier than that. But I think for the most part, we start to see this really happening in the mid 19th century. I know someone was asking, was there a Chinatown in Portland? So when you talk about like your grandfather going to Chinatown, can you be like
he would go to Boston.
Okay, Boston.
He had a car, and my understanding is at the time there it was rare for Chinese people to have a license and a car, but he had a car and would drive to Boston every month, which probably took quite a while back then before freeways and whatnot.
Someone else was asking too, do you know anything more about your grandfather's service in the military? So he actually served in the army, correct?
Yes.
During World War I?
Yeah. So this is interesting. I mentioned before about sort of history and memory and different types of knowledge, I guess. So when I was talking to my cousin Leo, he mentioned that he actually was in a training ground accident where he got shot. So he never did see, you know, he was never saw combat as far as I know, but he was definitely served for the United States in World War I. He was, I don't think, in the army for more than, it was less than a year, I believe. I'll have to look at the specific dates in his paperwork, but we have all of that paperwork. He was honorably discharged.
Someone's asking, can you explain again, exactly, do you know exactly how your family ended up in Portland specifically?
Yeah, so my thought on that is that he looks like my cousin is clarifying the training ground incident in the chat. My understanding is that, you know, the way that Chinese migration, like a lot of migration worked, right, is through family networks, or in the case of Chinese, like clan networks, like extended family sharing the same surname, but also through hometown associations. So Dogen would have sought out the other people, right, with the same surname, the Goon surname, and would have connected with them. So I'm fairly positive that the laundry, as I mentioned before, was purchased from another one, and someone else from that Goon clan association. that's how they ended up. I don't know how he ended up in the East Coast as opposed to the West Coast, but I think because of Chinese exclusion, it was probably easier to come over the Canadian border as opposed, you know, if it's quite easy, you know, we know about Angel Island, Chinese exclusion, Angel Island, basically all immigrants, right, were detained at an immigration station in the case of San Francisco, Angel Island, and then interrogated and then not released to land unless they were deemed to be a legitimate citizen. So I think to come in the way he did, right, more strategically, right, would be to come over the Canadian border. And it's likely that other family members, distant relatives had done the same thing and probably let him know that this was the way to do it, right? He wasn't that old when he came over, so he must have had someone who had shared that previous knowledge. And one of my historian colleagues, Madeline Shu, writes, and other people have written about this, but the Taishanese community, right, was transnational, right, at the turn of the century. There were gazetteers that would share news, right, from what was happening in China to the Chinese abroad. Chinese abroad would have positions, you know, governmental positions, or, you know, take part in local politics. So there it was very much networked even before we had, you know, the technology that we did now. So I think this knowledge was probably shared, you know, back home. And when he decided to come over, he was able to get some tips.
You know, are you aware of any other Chinese businesswomen in the Portland area, or maybe just other businesswomen in general that your grandmother might have worked with, been friends with?
I believe that one of the family friends, they owned a restaurant, but I don't know if the wife was probably involved, but I don't know if she was the sole proprietor of that. My understanding is it's fairly rare, right? Because she really didn't have a choice, right, after Dogen passed away. I'm sure the other women were quite involved in their husband's business behind the scenes. But, you know, in Paul Hsu's famous ethnography, The Chinese Laundryman, A Study in Social Isolation, he describes, this is in Chicago, the woman kind of always being hidden behind the counter. Right, and not really coming out. And clearly in Toi Lang Gum's situation, this wasn't an option. So I don't think it was any kind of large scale practice for Chinese women to be businesswomen in Portland. Within, you know, the larger context of Chinese American history, there certainly were female Chinese entrepreneurs, you know, like in the Western United States and whatnot, in Alaska. But there wasn't like a large community of Chinese female businesswomen.
Mm-hmm. Someone else is asking in the chat, to you and to Maine Historical Society, do we have information about Portland's overall immigrant population during this time period, the community, the attitudes towards new Americans, new Mainers? And the answer in context to Maine Historical Society is yes, we have a lot of information on that. As you heard Dr. Louis describe, there's a lot on Toi Lang Gun in our collection and a lot on new Mainers in our collection in general. I shared some online exhibits in the chat that you can find on Maine Memory Network. Maine Memory Network is a great place to get started to learn about Maine history from your own home. That website is mainemory.net. So you can see exhibits, online exhibits there about Chinese in Maine, about Toi Lang Gun and her story, the story of her family. You can also see the digital version of an exhibit that we had a couple years ago called 400 Years of New Mainers, which is about immigration in Maine. So if you're looking for a place to get started, Maine Memory Network is that place. And you can learn how to do your own research in our research library. much like Dr. Louie and Gary Libby have done, visit our website, mainhistory.org, and you can make an appointment to visit our research library and to learn more. Dr. Louie, can you speak to that any more? Like, how would you recommend someone who wants to know more about this topic or maybe more about their own family history like you've done? Where do you start? Where do you go?
Did you mention the Begin Again exhibit that's starting?
No, I should. I didn't, but I should have. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, you can do that, because I was going to say, you know, that's the focus of that exhibit, and it's online and in person. And I'm excited to see it in July.
Yeah, Begin Again, which this talk is part of our virtual series for that exhibit, looks at 500 years worth of history in what is today Maine, but also in North America, exploring topics like privilege, systemic racism, looking at how the law has protected or ignored certain populations, kind of giving our guests an opportunity to look at stories that maybe haven't heard before, or are being told from different perspectives. So you can, again, if you visit mainhistory.org, you can learn more about the exhibit, you can see the online version, and you can also buy tickets to come see it in person. Right now we're open Wednesday through Saturday, and it's real easy to do. You can make a reservation, buy your tickets online. Mm-hmm.
In terms of family history research, I think it really differs depending on what group you're looking at. For Chinese immigration history, because of exclusion, I think the fascinating thing is that there's an incredible amount of information, right? Because the government had to track Chinese immigrants. So they interviewed everyone when they came in. Interviewed later generations, like Toi Lan Goon, when she came in to see if her story matched my grandfather's. So it was very common, right, for new immigrants when they were interrogated, for the government to use its files, right, and cross-check information. Not all of the information is true, right, because a lot of Chinese Americans were paper sons. They would buy fake papers to come in under a different name. And that was fortunate in a way. Well, I shouldn't say, because of the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, that was not a fortunate incident at all. But for Chinese immigrants, right, it basically said they could, it resulted in the generation of many papers that were then sold to new immigrants. So the National Archives has a wealth of information, immigration files on these Chinese immigrants. And if your family has a certificate of identity, that's probably the best way to look up the file. And there are also a lot of online finding aids, or the people at the National Archives are extremely helpful. And then also, you know, your local historical society. So I was lucky that I had Gary Libby, who basically walked me in there, said, you know, this is the box, and you know, help me get photocopies of everything, and he keeps sending me more information. But you know, it's amazing what the local historical societies have, and online there are resources that you can search by keyword as well. I'm not an expert in doing family history research. Like I said, this is more of an academic project that's looking at her family history, you know, within a broader context, and also looking at what it means to people now.
One of the best things you've done from my perspective is taking advantage of talking to people in your family who have these memories, to kind of to start with them, to not be afraid to ask them questions. What do you remember? What was this? What was this like? You knew her. What can you tell me? Sometimes I think for people, if you don't know where else to start, sit down with someone in your family and just start asking questions. That, you know, tell me what you can remember, and you never know where that might take you.
Yeah, especially the older generations, right? So I did this project, this program called In Search of Roots when I was in graduate school, and we did family history and genealogy, and that inspired me. Even though I did my dad's side, it inspired me to interview my grandmother when she was she 100 or 101? And we now have her voice on tape. There's some other video of her available, but her telling her own story. But I also want to emphasize that, you know, history and memory are complicated, and those are things that, as an anthropologist, I want to explore. For example, when I asked her about, you know, my grandfather, she said that he was born in San Francisco. And, you know, we know that he wasn't, she knows that he wasn't, but my Aunt Amy said, well, maybe that's because you asked her in English. But, you know, and there's different ways that people remember my grandmother as well, sure, my generation. And, you know, I think memory is complicated. There's no one history. I mean, there are certain for facts, sure, that are unalterable, but I think what's also interesting is honoring people's memories and thinking about what her legacy means to people as they encounter things in the present, such as anti-Asian racism, or as they think about raising their own children, things like that.
Yeah, very well said. Well, thank you so much again for being here. This was a really interesting program. We really appreciate you sharing your time and your expertise. And we're very eager, please, when the book is published, we can't wait to read it. We would love to have you back to talk some more with our audience for Maine Historical Society. Is there anything else? I'll give you the last word before we close.
No, might take me a little while to finish up the book, but I'm excited and I'm learning so much from doing the research. And like I said, everyone's been so helpful, and I can't thank the Maine Historical Society enough for, you know, being such a supporter of, and of course, Gary Libby, of telling the story of the Chinese in Maine, because that's not something that you often hear about. And there's many more stories besides my grandmother's, I know, that are out there.
Well, we look forward to, I think this, programs like this will, I hope, inspire more research and more storytelling for us all. So thank you again for joining us. Thank you, everybody in the audience, for being here. And we look forward to seeing everybody back here soon.